Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's 10-state Super Tuesday primary elections and speak with a veteran Republican campaign strategist, Dan Schnur, who is now director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics at USC. We will discuss how much the bruising primary process is damaging the Republican brand and whether pragmatism will win out over passion tonight. Then we'll look into similarities between the Chechen War and the Syrian Civil War, since Russian tactics of targeting journalists apparently are being employed by the Assad regime with the help of their Russian ally. Robert Young-Pelton, a veteran war correspondent who covered the Second Chechen War and advised Marie Colvin, who was recently killed in Syria, how to stay alive and avoid Russian targeting in Chechnya, joins us. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria, When You Destroy a City, Make Sure No One, Not Even the Story, Gets Out Alive. Then finally, we will speak with Jacob Halbrun, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. We will discuss the Netanyahu-APAC neocon push for a war with Iran and the extent to which the White House either got a postponement until after November or will get a nasty surprise before the election. This now is Dan Schnur, the director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute for Politics at the University of Southern California. For years, Dan was one of California's leading political and media strategists, whose record includes work on 4 presidential and 3 gubernatorial campaigns. He served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain and spent 5 years as chief media spokesman for California Governor Pete Wilson. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Schnur.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And clearly today's contest, in many ways, at least it seems to me, to be within the Republican Party, a contest between the heart and the head. So given what's at stake on Super Tuesday, do you think tonight pragmatism or passion will win out?
Well, pragmatism looks like it's been making up some pretty serious ground over the last several days in the form of Mitt Romney, of course. 1 week ago, Santorum had a not sizable but noticeable lead in the polls in the state of Ohio. And Romney, as he did in Michigan the week before, has steadily been making up that ground. And when you look at public opinion polls, as you know, Ian, the raw numbers are really less important than the trajectory and the trends. And right now, the trend lines, at least in Ohio, are heading in Romney's direction.
So is this to do with his well-funded political machine? It's far outspent Santorum in Ohio. It's chopped down his double-digit opinion poll lead, almost level now.
The largest part of it is the money, and there's no question that the spending imbalance between Romney and his supporting super PAC in Santorum and his allies is what allowed Romney to come back in Ohio, in Michigan, and have certainly brought him back into the race in Ohio. The other thing that seems to be working in Romney's favor, although you can never tell for sure in such a close race, is it looks like some of the leading conservative Republican voices in the country are beginning to line up with Romney. People like Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader from Virginia, Tom Coburn, the very conservative senator from Oklahoma, are endorsing Romney, I suspect, less out of passion for him, going back to the premise of your first question, and more because they believe that it's time to wrap up this nominating process and get on to the general election. If Santorum does pull off an upset victory, and of course, all bets are off. But what you are beginning to see is an increasing number of conservative leaders who don't necessarily feel a lot of inspiration for Romney, feeling like it's time to get on board.
So, Dan Schnur, do you think that this long and bruising primary has damaged the Republican brand?
We don't know yet. Certainly, in the short run, it has. Romney and the other Republican candidates' head-to-head poll numbers against President Obama have suffered over the last couple months. But it's a question best to be considered in June. It's worth looking back. 4 years ago, candidate Barack Obama became a much better candidate between December of 2007 and June of 2008. He tremendously benefited from the ongoing challenge that Senator Clinton presented to him. At this point, Romney has not made that type of progress. But once again, it's something worth looking back at in June. If an elongated primary has made Romney a better candidate by June, then that's a great help to him going into a general election campaign. If it hasn't, then it's not.
Well, the latest Washington Post ABC News poll released today shows 35% of Americans view Mr. Romney favorably, compared to 32 for Mr. Paul, 23 for Gingrich, and 32 for Santorum. And one of the things that's an indicator that is, I think, may well be important here is that turnout overall is down 10% from 2008.
And that should be a real sign of concern, a real cause of concern for Republicans. There was an assumption going into this year's election that the unhappiness with Obama among grassroots conservative activists was such that there would be a great incentive to turn out to the polls. But in the early primary and caucus states, you're exactly right. Turnout has been down, just the opposite. And as the primary wears on, those Republican voters seem to be less inspired by their choices. Come fall, Romney or whoever turns out as the Republican nominee will be able to motivate those voters, if for no other reason than he'll be able to scare them about Barack Obama. But in the short run, the lack of that motivation is something that leading Republicans are and should be very concerned about.
Well, at today's White House press conference, there was an amusing moment. One of the reporters asked the president, saying that Mitt Romney had branded him as America's most feckless president since Jimmy Carter, and would the president have any comment to Mitt Romney? And the president paused and smiled rather mischievously and said, "Good luck tonight."
I didn't see that, but I have to believe that at least so far that the president and his advisors are greatly enjoying this this primary campaign. Like I said, there's no question that Romney can use the next few months to become a better candidate. But the way he's won these early primaries generally has been by running down and maligning his opponents. And should that trend continue, it's not the kind of thing that's going to prepare him particularly well for a general election campaign.
But, Dan Schnell, you were John McCain's director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign, and obviously you experienced close up and personal what happened to McCain in South Carolina. Has the sleaze that you were up against then, has that become the norm?
That has become the norm, sadly, in both parties. One of the unfortunate trend lines in American politics is that while most voters, truthfully, say that they do not care for negative campaigning, they're much more likely to remember a message presented in a negative or threatening way than a positive message. And if that sounds odd, I would ask every parent among your audience to ask themselves, when you have to ask your children to mow the lawn or wash the dishes, is the encouragement or the threat usually the best way to get it to happen? Political ad consultants have come to the same conclusion.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Schnell, director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute for Politics at the University of Southern California. He served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. And Barbara Bush has come out suggesting that she's extremely unhappy with this campaign, whether it's the nature of the campaign, the fratricide that bothers her, or the candidates. That's not clear. But it seems lately that Rush Limbaugh has been capturing the headlines in a way that seems, actually, there seems to be some fairly genuine outrage there, as much as I'm sure the Democrats are trying to gin it up. It does seem that quite a few people, perhaps in the center, are quite disturbed about it, about what he said. Do you think that Mitt Romney missed an opportunity there in terms of his sort of lukewarm remarks, in terms of obviously he's in the primary process moving to the right, but he's got to move back to the center at some point for the general, assuming he's the candidate? And I'm just wondering whether you can keep those kind of voters on hold for too long.
Well, Rush Limbaugh certainly did not do Romney or other Republican leaders any favors, because he took what was a fairly evenly divided debate between on the questions of government-funded contraception versus religious liberty, and turned it into a debate about contraception versus saying really mean things about college students. And that's a much tougher conversation to be part of. I would say this to you, Ian. If Limbaugh had made those comments a few weeks from now, my guess is you would have seen Romney be much more forceful in his denunciations of Limbaugh, because at that point, in all likelihood, he's going to be much further along the way to the nomination. In 1992, as you remember, and I'm suspecting many of your listeners do as well, candidate Bill Clinton offered a very strong denunciation of a rap singer by the name of Sister Souljah, who'd said some very inflammatory things about race relations in this country. But it's important to remember that Clinton pretty well had the Democratic nomination locked up at that point, so he could afford to challenge his base. Romney right now really needs those working-class voters who tend to listen to Rush Limbaugh in disproportionate numbers. A week from now, maybe even a day from now, he could have come out swinging on this. But right now, he didn't really have any good options in either direction.
Well, I must say I was struck by the front-page picture on today's New York Times, which is a picture of a blue-collar workers in Ohio being addressed by Romney, hard hats. And it struck me as, you know, such a paradox that in American politics, it seems that the Republicans are able to win a lot of blue-collar and working-class votes. And I'm surprised at how, apropos the question to the president today, Romney calling him the most feckless candidate since Carter. It seems that the Democrats are pretty feckless in regard to, you know, to wooing their very own base.
Well, the great sea change in American politics over the last generation, Ian, has essentially been a trade-off between the two parties. It used to be that the single greatest indicator of partisan voting behavior, whether you would vote Republican or Democrat, was income. The wealthier you were, the more likely you were to vote Republican. The less economic means you had, the more likely you were to vote Democrat. That's changed. That's no longer the case. And rather than income, the single greatest demographic indicator is no longer income, but rather the frequency with which an individual attends religious services. Way back in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton and Dianne Feinstein and any number of Democrats began reaching out to the so-called soccer moms and soccer dads, economically successful suburban parents who tended to be more moderate to liberal on social and environmental issues, at the same time, Republicans were reaching out to the so-called NASCAR dads and moms, working-class blue-collar voters who tended to be more culturally conservative. And so over the years, the type of voters that Mitt Romney naturally attracts, oddly enough, are no longer the same a vital part of the Republican base that they once were. And Romney's great challenge, of course, is reaching out to these NASCAR parents, and that's something he's really struggled with.
So just looking down the road here, because obviously tonight's elections on Super Tuesday, some of it's pretty predictable, I guess. Romney is likely to win, certain to win Massachusetts.
It's a brave call, yeah.
Vermont, Virginia, that's even braver because two of the guys aren't even on the ballot. And then there's a likelihood of Ron Paul winning North Dakota and Alaska and Gingrich winning Georgia. That only leaves Ohio, Tennessee, and Oklahoma. Ohio, of course, is the one that everybody's talking about being so key. I guess there's no question about that, right?
That's exactly right. You know, 10 primaries in caucus states up tonight. One that matters more than the rest of them combined. If Romney does manage to win Ohio, for the reasons that we talked about earlier, then it's very difficult to see a situation under which Santorum or any other Republican candidate poses a serious threat from this point forward. And while it will be some time before Romney has secured the nomination, statistically speaking, a win in Ohio pretty much puts him on a glide path there. If Santorum wins Ohio, then we're back to square one. And I suspect we might end, if Santorum wins Ohio and the doubts about Romney's capabilities as a candidate reemerge among Republican primary voters, we could in fact end up seeing a contested California primary out here in June, which if nothing else means we get to see Rick Santorum without the sweater vest.
Well, you mean he's not going to go as far as in a Hawaiian shirt, I don't
know. No, but I'm thinking June in L.A.
Right. That's true. Tell me, though, about a long-term possibility here, Dan Schneider. If Santorum were to get the nomination, and a lot of pundits expect that it would be a blowout akin to the Goldwater blowout, would that therefore diminish the future prospects of the Tea Party? And conversely, if Romney is defeated, wouldn't that revive the Tea Party?
I would say this, that if Obama is reelected, immediately Republican conservatives and what's left of the Republican establishment will immediately blame each other. So it's difficult to see the party reformulating itself in either way after a defeat, at least in a significant way. But your point about a Santorum nomination is an important one. And as we talked about earlier, we've started to see a number of prominent conservatives like Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, coming out for Romney. And as we discussed earlier, it's not out of love for Mitt Romney. It's that Cantor would rather be House Majority Leader than House Minority Leader. And he worries that a Santorum at the top of the ticket would not just lose by a very wide margin, but bring down a lot of Republican congressional candidates with him.
Well, there's a lot of talk, though, that, of course, that this whole process, this long primary process, has damaged the brand, as we mentioned earlier, and that often in the press it's referred to as Republican power brokers. And I'm curious, you obviously know whether or not they exist, are there backroom power brokers? Because they keep talking about, at least speculating, the possibility of a brokered convention. And my reading of history indicates that that's somewhat absurd. I mean, the last time we had a brokered convention was Eisenhower versus Taft. Eisenhower worked for those delegates. He wasn't, you know, the notion that somebody like a Jeb Bush can come in on a white horse and suddenly claim the nomination, where does that stuff come from?
Well, it comes from reporters and politicos and news consumers who like drama. The same reason you'd rather see a basketball game that goes into overtime than one in which one team wins by 30 points. It's simply more interesting to watch a contest that continues than the one that resolves itself early.
But it's drama based on fiction.
Point is the right one. But I would actually draw a distinction between a brokered convention, which cannot exist in America today because power brokers do not exist in either party with the kind of influence it would take to handpick a nominee in a smoke-filled room. But on the other hand, a contested convention in which legitimately a party arrives at its convention without a settled nominee. That's unlikely. A brokered convention is impossible for all the reasons you mentioned, Ian. Those brokers just don't exist anymore. Or if they do, they don't have the power that they once did. But a contested convention, while unlikely, is a possibility. But if Romney does win Ohio and continues on this path, obviously every week that possibility shrinks.
Well, just in closing, what's your hunch about tonight?
The momentum is certainly with Romney. And if he does not win Ohio, that would be a surprise, not a huge one, but a surprise. And if he does win Ohio and perhaps Tennessee, then I think you'll see increasing pressure on Santorum in particular to stand down. And by the Illinois primary 2 weeks from today, you'd probably see him making one last brave effort before moving on. So nothing's absolute, but the winds seem to be blowing in Romney's direction.
But when you say pressure, though, that's not pressure from the non-existent backroom power brokers. It's pressure from what? Donors for Santorum's future career as a lobbyist? How does that pressure manifest itself?
Well, interesting. It's a great question. It's a great point. And in 21st century America, that pressure comes not from power brokers or from donors, but from voters who increasingly are interested in seeing their party win a general election. One thing we are seeing in the early primary polls is increasing number of Republican voters who are picking their candidate based not on the person with whom they align most comfortably ideologically, but the candidate who they think can win. And I think should Romney win Ohio tonight, if Santorum and Gingrich do go forward, they'll see increasing resistance among primary voters who simply want to see this nomination settled and move on to a general election.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dan Schnur.
Happy to join you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dan Schnur, who's the director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California. For years, Dan was one of California's leading political and media strategists, whose record includes work on 4 presidential and 3 gubernatorial campaigns. He served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain and spent 5 years as chief media spokesman for California Governor Pete Wilson. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking to a veteran war correspondent who covered the Chechen wars and sees similarities that perhaps indicate the Russians are helping the Syrians target journalists.
رقم واحد للشعب السوري ساير.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist and explorer, and a founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He's had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel and insurgent groups, and his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria. When you destroy a city, make sure no one, not even the story, gets out alive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hey, good afternoon, Ian.
And you, in your foreign policy piece, you start out by talking about when you were in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, and you were with the Chechen rebel commander, that you left the safe house with him to go into an area, a bombed-out area, about 15 minutes away, and then you fired up, put a battery in your satellite phone. He made a quick call, and then immediately you got out of there, took the batteries out of there, and no sooner were you out of that place than the Grad rockets came in, which of course indicates that the Russians were targeting satellite phones. And clearly you and your Chechen rebel that you're with understood that. I understand that when you were leaving Chechnya, you ran into Marie Colvin, the woman who was killed recently in Syria. And she asked you to brief her on how to stay alive, and you did. But curiously, it sounds like she didn't follow the advice you gave her in Syria.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that the Chechen War was the first of the dozen wars that I've covered where I saw journalists specifically being targeted and being killed. The telephone call that the Chechen commander made on my behalf was actually looking for a Frenchman named Brice Fletcher who had been kidnapped just before I went in, and was found later chained to a basement. So it was an ugly war, and it was very clear that journalists had no safe harbor. When I came out, and you have to remember, after a very long period of being attacked and surrounded, and there was little mercy shown to my compatriots, I met with Marie, and I told her that this was not your regular war. This is something, as soon as you fire up that sat phone or you make a phone call, they are going to start hunting you down, and they're going to stop either firing rockets at you or else dropping bombs on you. And she clearly understood the risk. And I think, to be fair to Marie, I think she was aware that when she was in Syria, but she didn't actually believe that the Syrian government would fire rockets at the media center to kill her. Because you have to remember, she was on television the night before she was killed, talking to ITV and Anderson Cooper, and basically saying to people that she was staying in the media center.
Well, the media center, though, was also rebel headquarters, wasn't it?
Correct. And, I mean, these are sort of the terminology that we have to be careful of, because obviously the rebels are using journalists to broadcast messages and images of dead babies and, you know, shelled civilians. But, you know, that's the job of journalists. I mean, it's up to us to decide whether that's right or wrong or good or bad. But when a legitimate government decides that it's going to kill those messengers, even though they're not combatants, it does change the rules a little bit.
So what is there, though, to indicate that the Russians have trained the Syrians in this technique? Because the Russians didn't want anybody covering the Chechen War. That's pretty clear. Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist who made a reputation for covering it, was poisoned on a plane going down there, almost died, and was subsequently murdered on Putin's birthday. So there's no question that the Syrians have the same attitude. They won't let journalists in the first place. And just the other day, they wouldn't let in the human rights, UN's human rights monitor, who apparently has finally been let in. And Kofi Annan is now waiting to be let in. And apparently this footage that British television broadcast of Syrian troops going through a hospital, murdering people in the hospital beds, has been authenticated. So there's no question what is happening in Syria are crimes against humanity. And I imagine the war criminals that are doing it don't want the world to see.
Well, Ian, you have to look at the tactics. I mean, these tactics are not new. They've been ever since Attila the Hun made, you know, mountains out of skulls. But what you're seeing is almost a textbook copy of what the Russians did in the Second War. You know, they had their heads handed to them in the First War, literally. In the Second War, what they decided to do was essentially to silence. In other words, cut off all the cell phone communications, stop any communications, surround the city, pulverize it with artillery, allow a small window for some civilians to escape, and then pulverize the rest, and then go in and what they call jaquista, or cleansing, go in and arrest and execute a large number of military-aged males, plus any suspects that they wanted to identify. These are tactics that the Russians use, but, you know, are Russians doing it? No. But Syria is purchasing $1 billion worth of weapons from Russia. There are at least, you know, over a dozen documented Russian advisors in Syria now, helping them with tactics and strategies. And it is, like I say, a textbook copy of what the Russians did successfully in Grozny against a very similar type of uprising.
So, again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria, When You Destroy a City, Make Sure No One, Not Even the Story, Gets Out Alive. Now, the Qataris and the Saudis seem to be arming the Free Syrian Army, and they've been doing so for some time. In fact, I believe the Qataris have sent in a brigade in there. But in your article at Foreign Policy, Robert Young-Pelton, you mentioned that Qatar provided 3,000 satellite phones to the Syrian rebels. So I guess that indicates, one, that satellite phones are incredibly important, and two, what you just said is they're also important to the Syrian government to use them for targeting.
Right, and the only reason I wrote this article at the request of Foreign Policy was they also saw some very striking similarities between what I would call information operations. In other words, direct targeting of people who provide information, whether it's being rebels with propaganda or civilians with horror stories, or even the journalists who are brought in by the rebels to cover the story. And Syria clearly sees that as a major threat to what they call the Libyanization of the conflict, where, you know, in Libya we had a very unpopular leader and international forces decided to get behind the rebels, and that same media machine was used to turn them into freedom fighters. Now you're seeing, you know, these guys in Syria being turned into terrorists and Wahhabists and Saudi-backed fundamentalists. And that's essentially what Russia did in Grozny with the Chechens. They took a group of people who were part of the Soviet army before the breakup and decided to call them all terrorists. And it's a very ugly, complicated information war. But I see the exact same hallmarks in Syria.
So is that to say that the Russians are not just advising the Syrian military, they're also advising the Assads in terms of propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, if you read the Russian media, you know, forget the Western media, and look at what Putin is saying about Syria and about the need for Western governments to stay out, you can see whose side. I mean, there's a huge split forming, you know, between Russian-backed governments like Iran and Syria, and, of course, Western-backed intentions. And Hillary Clinton was sort of caught sitting on the fence being interviewed by CBS and not really knowing who the rebels are and not really wanting to make an opinion either way. And this is one thing that's very important, is that when people like Marie Colvin get killed and they send up passionate stories of dead babies and slaughtered civilians, sometimes the poll numbers overtake the politicians' facts, and we get pushed into engagement in these wars.
So Putin's a big player here, because not only is he advising his Syrian surrogates, and it does feel like, to some extent, a sort of a revival of a Cold War proxy war. But Putin, of course, was the one who prosecuted the Second Chechen War. He blew up the apartment building in Moscow in order to, as a provocation to get the country into this war, and micromanaged it himself. So he's certainly the right person to be able to give them advice.
Yeah, and then once again, I reflect Putin's goals, which is to create sort of his orb of influence, against our goals, which is to create democratic institutions. And in the middle is this sense of, you know, do we want the Muslim Brotherhood to run Egypt? Do we want Saudi-backed Islamists to run Syria? And it seems like we're almost not part of that conversation anymore.
Well, already, I think, didn't Hillary Clinton sort of indicate that, whereas the United States is not prepared to send arms, and, you know, as you know, Robert Young-Pelton and John McCain call for the use of the U.S. Air Force to target Syrian tanks, which, of course, is an absurd non-starter. but Secretary of State Clinton indicated that the U.S. wouldn't be sending any arms, but other people are, and that they, I guess, what, they're turning a blind eye to the Saudi and the Qatari arms that are flowing into the Free Syrian Army?
Well, you're seeing a slight shift because the U.S. has no problem using proxies or, you know, friendly states to stand up. I mean, we hid behind the NATO shield in Libya. We didn't really bang our drum until it was over. But we spent, $1 billion dropping bombs on Libyan weapons. And if we do stand for human rights, I don't see any problem with making a public stand about what needs to be done and what we think should be done, and supporting countries who we normally don't get along with in arming rebels or at least helping people get their freedom. But here's the point. I mean, the point is that we are making decisions in a vacuum. You know, once the journalists are scared out of Homs and those regions, we don't know what's going on, so we can't make intelligent decisions. So even today, a war rages in Chechnya, even though they have shiny apartment buildings and a government, and Putin apparently won a mass victory in the recent election, but I don't know who to believe anymore.
Well, if you have the Russians hands-on arming and advising the Syrian regime, and on the other side, you have the Saudis and the Qataris covertly supporting the Free Syrian Army, Turkey right next door sitting on the fence, the United States sitting on the fence, Israel sitting on the fence. It seems like a one-sided proxy war.
Well, you know, there's always the wild card. For example, Syria was supposed to be a somewhat moderate quasi-dictatorship like, you know, Saddam Hussein was in Iraq, and you saw how that flipped around. So what I see here is a dramatic upheaval in who actually runs the Middle East, and for once it might actually be Islamic or Muslim countries or even Arab countries making their own decisions in that region and not bothering to ask us for our advice, as you see with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who arbitrarily made the decision to send weapons and support into the rebels.
So do you think then that the President Obama in his press conference today, Robert Young-Pelton, said that Assad would eventually go? What do you think the U.S. policy is, to let the others carry the water and the Syrian people are going to bleed for a while and eventually Assad will go and his Russian backers presumably will be pretty unhappy about it?
Well, the ugly truth is that Syria pays their rent checks with about 30% of its income coming from oil, and it's always better to deal with the dictator you know than the dictator you don't know. The danger card here is that when you look at Saudi Arabia and other countries that have the same inequities inside them, the U.S. has to draw a line somewhere. Who are we going to support and who are we going to let fall? And Syria is really, to me, the linchpin. If we are going to support Syria, we have to actually explain why we have supported Syria or not supported Syria in the past. Right now we have sanctions against them. They're supposedly bad boys. But do we also look at the alternative, and are we explaining to the population what happens if we do or don't support the rebels or the Syrian government? I don't see that kind of conversation going on.
Well, I spoke a few weeks ago with Bob Baer, who's in touch with the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, the leadership, and they were complaining to him. He told me they were complaining to him that the State Department won't talk to them. And Bob said, well, what are you guys going to do once you win against the Alawites? And this Brotherhood guy said, we're going to kill them all. To which Bob said, well, little wonder the State Department doesn't want to talk to you.
Well, this is the reality of revolutions and insurgencies. You know, you're always dealing with the most hardcore elements, but you know, one thing I see happening in Syria is where the Syrian army was essentially a group of military people who rebelled and were fighting a fairly military war. And now what you're seeing is that war turning more into a fundamentalist type of jihad. And, you know, had we engaged these people when they were sort of normal Western structures rather than let it drop into the sort of endless jihad type war that these things turn into, we might have had a political solution.
But Assad didn't allow for any space. As soon as any protest reared its head, he squashed it ruthlessly.
Well, but you have to understand, once America gets in via NATO or any other mechanism and his tanks start exploding, those dictators pay attention because that military is the one that keeps them in power. And if they start vaporizing at a rapid rate, they will quickly come to the negotiating table or be kicked out of power. You saw that with Gaddafi, where you just basically vaporized his entire military, so he had nothing to do. But I just see that we have to have a very clear understanding of what we want to do with Syria. You know, I'm not backing the rebels or the Syrian government. I'm just saying that our government is waffling and watching these humanitarian crises unfold. And when the media goes in and tries to expose these things, Syria brutalizes these people until they don't cover it anymore. So once we have that vacuum, then the State Department doesn't have any pressure.
Well, that's clearly the situation it is today, but the alternative of repeating what happened in Libya doesn't seem to be on the cards, does it? I mean,
the alternative is Chechnya. You know, Chechnya was a breakaway republic. It had an election that was monitored. It had a non-fundamentalist government. Yes, it had criminality and terrorism, et cetera, but it was a functioning state. And when Putin went to war against it on the second war, he decided that there was a group of fundamentalist insurgents and had to wipe out most of the country. And we've seen those amazing satellite photos of before and after, which look very much like the before and after photos that Human Rights Watch published of Homs and Bab al-Mandeb.
Well, that's your suspicions that of the Russian hand in being involved in what's happening in Syria in terms of of the tactics. So who's going to step in then if the U.S. is going to waffle? And if, as you say, Robert Young-Pelton, the press have been pretty much intimidated into getting out of there because of what happened, because the Syrian military are actively targeting the press. They want them out. They don't want any witnesses. So if nobody covers it and it continues to go, and the Syrian army is now moving against, I mean, they're moving piecemeal against the rebels, aren't they?
But for example, what you're saying is Saudi Arabia, who is not known to be a major overt supporter of insurgencies, pouring money into Syria. And that's a fairly formidable ally. And then you've seen Qatar, which, once again, another oil-rich, family-run country, pouring significant resources and weapons and funding into a revolution. And obviously there's a price to pay once you take that money. But I'm just saying that we're seeing the roots of a different type of Middle Eastern support system.
So at the end of the day, then, when the president says that eventually Assad will be toppled, it's not going to be by the U.S., it's going to be by the Saudis and the Qataris?
Right, and then you're going to have to deal with a completely different animal when it comes to negotiating who gets their resources and oil and who runs the country. And once again, these decisions could have been made now as opposed to after the fact.
Well, one thing that won't happen if the Saudis have any say is the Arab Spring, right?
Yes. I mean, the idea of family-owned empires dropping like flies is not a favorable concept to the Saudis or the Qataris.
Well, isn't that the amazing kind of irony here? If one family regime in Saudi Arabia gets rid of another family regime in Syria?
Yeah, but I think that is what we're seeing. We're seeing a slightly different ship. We sort of messed it up in Iraq, and you're seeing these Gulf nations take more control over the future of their region, which means we have less control in deciding who runs these countries.
So just in closing, let's talk a little bit about going back to Marie Colvin, who you knew, and particularly you knew her from the Chechen War, which is what we've been talking about here, the similarities between what happened in Chechnya and what's happening in Syria now. And you advised her on how the Russians were targeting the use of cell phones, and clearly that's what happened in Syria, that the cell phones, the satellite phones were used there. CNN seems to have sort of, didn't they have a long interview from the very same place?
I mean, it actually started with Darwa Damon. Darwa Damon, she was broadcasting from the same building and live, and it wasn't any secret where she was, and they flattened the top floor of the four-story building after she left. So that was a clear message to any journalist that wanted to broadcast from there. Marie and other journalists came in after that, and then once again very publicly went on television internationally and in print and radio, and very specifically said where they were staying. And then the next morning they finished off the building. So it wasn't any surprise or any great secret.
What explains it to you there for a veteran war correspondent like that who wasn't suicidal or reckless? She was apparently a very courageous woman, but
I think, based on my experience, you get caught.
Sorry, can you repeat that? Your phone's breaking up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's still breaking up. Yeah.
Let's try this again. How's this?
Better, yeah.
Okay. I think what happens is you get caught up in the tone of the event. You're with a bunch of survivors. You're getting continually bombarded with rockets and bombs, and you sort of develop this what-the-hell kind of approach. And so I just felt from the way she talked and the anger in her voice and the topic she was focused on that she was just angry. She wanted the message and the images and the concept of complete brutality to get out there, and she was willing to pay the consequences. And, you know, she was 50, in her mid-50s, so she probably thought, you know, if she heard rockets coming in, or, you know, she could escape them, but she didn't. Apparently she got killed going back to get her shoes and the rockets landed, so she could have survived.
Well, I understand that prior to the rockets coming in, that she had witnessed a young child who had a shrapnel wound to the stomach die in front of her.
Right, and that was the day before, and I think she wanted to get that message out. It was very important to her to go as wide and as deep as she could with that story, because she felt that people needed to take action. And it's a common theme in journalism to say that nobody's doing anything, these people are dying, and it's also exacerbated by the people in these places who are essentially terrified and feel like the world is ignoring them. So journalists tend to adopt that same tone and don't really think about the consequences, and she paid the ultimate price.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Young-Pelton.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I mean, speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He's had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups, and his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Kill the Messenger, What Russia Taught Syria. When you destroy a city, make sure no one, not even the story, gets out alive. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not Netanyahu and the neocons have been dissuaded from going to war against Iran.
If you raise up your hand, you better raise up your clan. Fix up, master, and think about it, man. But wait.
Do you really wanna fight?
Yes, me.
Do you really wanna fight?
You must be crazy.
Do you really wanna fight?
Yes, who?
Do you really wanna fight?
Trust me.
Do you really wanna fight?
Think about it, man. Think before you run. Cause you're not get far when you're done. You better call for the law, think you run. You better call for the law, think you run.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jacob Halbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbron.
Thanks, Ian.
And I'm trying to sort of get a sense now of whether or not the combination of Netanyahu, AIPAC, and the neocons who have dominated the news in the last few days with the AIPAC's annual meeting in Washington and the visit to the White House by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the parade of people speaking at AIPAC, whether or not the president dodged the bullet in terms of a war against Iran before the elections, which would undoubtedly hurt his re-election campaign, not to mention cause the American taxpayer to pay through the roof for gasoline, etc. So what's your sense of...
Yeah, I think he has. And if anything, I suspect that the recent days have reconfirmed Obama's aversion to going to war. And if you wanted to concoct a plot to strip Obama of the presidency, the best thing would be to force him to go to war. And maybe that's Netanyahu's ulterior motive, which is that if America and or Israel were to bomb Iran, gasoline prices today at $4 or $5 would look like a mere pittance compared to $10 to $20 a gallon in the aftermath of a war.
So, how do you explain the idea that a very small foreign country can basically come hold the superpower as a supplicant, dictate terms, play the opposition off against the incumbency? And still basically hold most of the cards.
Well, it is amazing. When Netanyahu addresses Congress, it has the feel of a Politburo meeting, the blind fealty displayed by Congress. But I think that is the answer, that the congressmen are afraid of AIPAC and of not being reelected, and they need the money and they need the votes. And it's no different than the Cuba lobby.
Well, except that the Cuba lobby have been spectacularly unsuccessful at getting rid of Castro.
True, but they've held American foreign policy hostage on Cuba.
Right. But in this case...
If this were rational, we would have relations with Cuba, which is not as tyrannical as many other regimes that we have relations with.
Sure.
But ultimately, I think it is that AIPAC has assiduously targeted Congress over the past two decades, and it is a triumph of lobbying.
Well, it's a triumph of lobbying to get to have gotten this Iran war to the point where it is front and center for a country that's war-weary, and its people are war-weary, and yet the Republican candidates, most of whom addressed AIPAC via video, were making the most incredibly belligerent speeches.
They were, though. If you notice, Romney's op-ed today in the Washington Post, I read it carefully, and it's full of condemnatory language of Obama calling him feckless. But as the New York Times points out, the end result for all his bluff and bombast, Romney does not stake out any position that is an iota different from Obama's. He just talks about the threat of war, which Obama has talked about as well, and he calls for upping sanctions, which Obama has already done. What the Republicans are doing is caricaturing President Obama, who's taken out a tougher line on Iran than George W. Bush did. If it was so easy to attack Iran, then why didn't Bush do it?
So, are the politicians on Capitol Hill, who are obviously beholden to AIPAC and are acting like vassals, and the president, who's extremely careful, but at least is holding his ground as they try to buffalo him into a war? Do you think the American people are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, you know, we give a lot of money to this country. They seem to be not only ungrateful, they're trying to dictate what we do. And if we go along with what they want to do, it'll be a catastrophe for us and for the world and for the global economies. What the hell's going on here?
Well, I think it would only come to that point if war actually ensued, and then the catastrophic effects were felt in the United States. Only then would people reexamine or reassess their relationship with Israel. But for now, the focus is on Iran. And, of course, Americans have loathed this country since 1979, since it began calling us the Great Satan. So I don't think going to war would necessarily be unpopular, but I do think the consequences would be wildly unpopular. The latest poll suggests that a war with Iran is more unpopular in Israel than it is among the American electorate.
And I understand that one in five Israelis only support a unilateral action without American support. So it looks like the vast majority of the Israeli public recognize how important relations with of keeping the alliance with the United States strong.
Yeah, I think Netanyahu is bluffing and does not have the capability to take out the Iranian facilities effectively. What the proponents of a war with Iran want is not the nuclear weapons per se. They want regime change. That's something that Bret Stephens explicitly called for in the Wall Street Journal, a prominent neocon. This is not about nuclear weapons. This is at bottom about regime change.
But attacking a regime is the worst possible way to bring about regime change. It surely will have the effect of having the Iranians, as much as they apparently loathe this regime, at least the educated urban Iranians do. Wouldn't it have the rally around the flag effect?
It might, but even beyond that, it would completely take any pressure off Assad in Syria. I think Obama correctly pointed out all of the effects of a unprovoked attack on Iran are negative.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Jacob Halbrand, the senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And we're talking about the combined efforts of the neocons, AIPAC and Netanyahu, beating the drums of war here, which have dominated the headlines in the last few days, and what's been going on in Washington. Now, in Netanyahu's speech to AIPAC last night, he dramatically displayed copies of an exchange of letters between the World Jewish Congress and the U.S. War Department at the height of the Holocaust in 1944, letters that implored the U.S. government to bomb Auschwitz. And Netanyahu read from these letters, and the War Department's response, quoting, "Such an operation could be executed only by diverting considerable air support essential to the excess of our forces elsewhere, and in any case would be of such doubtful efficacy that it would not warrant the use of our resources." And then Netanyahu said, and here's the most remarkable sentence of all, and I quote, "Such an effort might provoke even more vindictive actions from the Germans." And then Netanyahu said, "But here's my point. The Jewish people today, we have a state of our own. The purpose of the Jewish state is to secure the Jewish future. That is why Israel must always have the ability to defend itself by itself against any threat." Now, that's pretty clear, isn't it? That he's basically saying at the time of the Holocaust, America and the West let us down. And we can't rely on them again.
Yes, but it's still a crass perversion of history. The truth is, yes, the War Department and the Roosevelt administration and the Allies did behave disgracefully. Auschwitz could have been bombed. The thing could have been shut down in 1944 with very little effort. But we are not at war with Iran now. We were at war with Nazi Germany in 1944. And Iran does not have gas chambers going, and it does not even, we don't even know if it has the capability of building a bomb or if it's bluffing. And to rush into war on the basis of invoking the Holocaust, the worst, most searing crime of the 20th century, is wholly inappropriate, in my view. I think it is a misuse of the Holocaust. And again, this is something you need to be very careful about. And the Holocaust analogy is simply overused. This is not 1939. This is not Munich. The West is not appeasing Iran. It is upping the pressure on Iran tremendously with the sanctions. To go to war now would be wholly precipitous.
Well, I only bring this up, Jacob Halbrand, because this was the speech that was made last night after whatever deals were made at the White House, about which we know very little.
Yes.
All we know is that it looks as though the president's been able to hold off Netanyahu until after the elections, and there'd be no guarantee that he's not given a guarantee that he won't do something before the elections. The assumption is that the trade-off is that Obama has said, look, just hold off, and after the elections, then, we'll work with you, and if sanctions don't work, then we can use the military option, and by the way, we have the military capability and you don't. That's the assumption, but the fact that after this meeting he brings up this whole plays the Holocaust card, indicates to me that this is not a guy who's if he's made an agreement, he's not exactly comfortable with it. And this, he strikes me as this guy's a kind of a wild card.
He is an unscrupulous leader who will stop at little, and I don't think that he has the upper hand in the relationship. In a second term, if Obama is reelected, he would also have more maneuvering room, since he would not be up for a reelection. And I think, depending on the size of his victory, again, these are all imponderables. But I think Obama has displayed a pretty cool head and is holding off what amounts to a spasm of war fever in the Capitol, artificially whipped up by AIPAC and other organizations. The Iran problem is no greater than the North Korea problem, if that great, and no one's calling for attacking North Korea.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Jacob Halbron, in terms of, you said that maybe the fact that Obama will be reelected and Netanyahu is going to have to live with a president who's by no means happy with him, that may be having a sobering effect. Just in terms of the way the Super Tuesday is working out, we don't know about Ohio at this point. It's about Romney's only had but 40-37. CNN have declared Tennessee for Santorum. Oklahoma, Santorum's ahead. The other states have come out as predicted. Romney won Massachusetts, Vermont, and Virginia. And of course, Gingrich and Santorum weren't even on the ballot in Virginia. I don't know what the story is in Alaska, North Dakota. Apparently, Ron Paul's likely to do well up there. So I guess the key one is Ohio, and that's pretty close, right? So what's your sense of where it stands?
Well, my sense in thinking about this in recent days, and I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, but is that the problem the Republican Party faces, and I've never doubted that Obama would be reelected, is that it isn't even principally the candidates. It's the party itself. Anyone who runs for the nomination now has to embrace stands that are inherently nonsensical, both on domestic and foreign policy. It's not a viable party at this moment that you can run from. I mean, it forces its candidates, even if they are halfway reasonable, to contort themselves into pretzels. The only one who has actually talked sense on a number of issues is Ron Paul, because he has nothing to lose.
Well, Jacob Halbron, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halbron, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.